All right. Well, hey, thank you for being here tonight. We are in the framework books again. They look like this right here. They're online. We're going to be doing our second part of the Old Testament overview, covering the years 1446 to 931, or basically the time of the Exodus up until the end of Solomon's reign. And we are on page 100, chapter 19 of the framework book, and we'll be referring obviously to the Bible, going over several things. But first of all, as we look at the pictures that I've got here, this is a chart that we've got up in our Tuesday night Bible study showing the time of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Joseph dies in 1805 B.C., and we know who the Pharaoh was, Amenhotep III and Neferusgokesobek, up until 1802. And if you remember, in the book of Genesis, Abraham was told, your descendants will be slaves in a foreign nation for four generations, or 400 years is how long they're going to be there. So beginning apparently right around the time that the Jacob arrives, Joseph's death right in there, if you generally subtract 1800 and you subtract 400 years from there, you end up with 1400 BC. And so somewhere in this time period is, here's Pharaoh's dreams, 1859. Joseph dies in 1805. Somewhere in this time period, maybe towards the end of Joseph's life, some kind of slavery began to take place of the Hebrews that had gone down into Egypt. And after 400 years, the year is going to be 1446 is when we think the Exodus takes place. You subtract 40 years from that, of the 40 years of wandering the wilderness, you've got 1406 BC, and Joshua is entering the promised land. And these are, you know, you can discuss all this, and you can look at different research, but this is pretty solid. 1446 is the date of the Exodus, 1406 the entrance into the land, and the beginning of the book of Joshua during that time period. So with that being said, we need to talk about who is the Pharaoh. Well, we got 1446. That's Moses was 40 years old in 1446. So if you add 40 years to that, you're going to get 1486, or around 1485, 86 BC, Moses is going to be born right here. And what we have on that very first page, and I'll just try to breeze through this again. This is a lot of information to start with. But on that very first page, the Hyksos, a Semitic people, invaded Egypt around 1560 BC. Amenhotep was the pharaoh at that time, and he reigned with the help of his son, Thutmose I. Now again, we're going to have Thutmose I, Thutmose II, and Thutmose III. So Thutmose I, the second, and Thutmose III. This Thutmose is going to be a good king, great king, a good leader. He's going to have a son named Thutmose II, who's going to be very weak. He's also going to have a daughter named Hatshepsut. And again, Hatshepsut, I'll spell it something like that. And these are his children. Hatshepsut and Thutmose, they're going to marry, and they're going to have a son. But Thutmose II is going to have another son called Thutmose III with a harem wife. And this is Thutmose III. In this story right here, Hatshepsut is going to be the Pharaoh's daughter who takes Moses out of the Nile River, because they start killing. Thutmose I is going to order that all the babies be killed because they're getting too numerous, and they're going to begin just getting rid of them because they're afraid of the slaves and what they're going to become. Moses' parents put him in a basket, you know, covered with pitch, and Hatshepsut goes out and draws him out of the water and decides, well, I'll just keep him and I'll raise him. So Moses is going to be raised in the palace, and he's going to be raised, this would be in a sense his father and mother, but mainly his mother Hatshepsut. Moses is going to be the same generation as Thutmose III. Thutmose II is going to die, and Hatshepsut is going to convince everybody. A lot of these things are, again, Egyptian history is something to be discussed and looked at, and there's different ways of viewing it. But Hatshepsut is going to convince the people, apparently, that Thutmose I intended for her to reign instead of Thutmose II, and she is going to take Thutmose III because he's too young yet, and she's going to begin to rule and reign, and she's going to rule along with him while he's a child, you know, 5, 10, I'm not sure exactly how old he is, and she's going to rule and reign with him with intention of having Moses take the place. She's going to have her adopted son. Now notice the name Moses. Thutmose I, Thutmose II, Thutmose. This means Thut is born. This is Thut is the name of the god. Thut is born. Or Thut, the son is here. He's come, the coming. The God is here. And this is the birth, the born, the coming. Thutmose I, Thutmose II, Thutmose III. Now Moses, when he gets in trouble, he is going to basically, it appears, drop the name of the foreign god, Thut. And what do you have left? When you get rid of Thut, what do you got left? Moses. And that is the name of Moses. It's the family name that he kept with him the whole time. That is what is being said right here on this first page. And you can research that if you want to and go through that. Now, something takes place. Moses sees the slaves being beaten or abused by the slave masters, and he goes off and he argues or strikes one, and he kills one of the slave masters. And he realizes he's in trouble with the royal. Now, apparently, Hatshepsut is now the pharaoh. There's indication that she dressed herself up as a man, not that she was transgender or cross-dressing, but she took the role of the male figure, the leader of the empire, and she had many monuments, many inscriptions. But when Moses, we don't know how connected this is, but when Moses killed someone and had to flee the country, her popularity starts to collapse, and Thutmose III rebels against her, takes over as the pharaoh, and erases her name. You can see her name has been replaced, carved out, and things carved over it or just snuffed out. The name of Hatshepsut is removed. Then that's Egyptian history. And there's a whole you can see the tombs. You can see they had Hatshepsut had a daughter named Neferuri, and it appears that Neferuri was going to marry Moses. That would have been the typical union. Hatshepsut's daughter would have married Moses, her adopted son, and they would have been the next pharaoh in that place. Well, Hatshepsut dies. Thutmose erases her name from history, and it's like, well, why is there no evidence that Moses was in Egypt? Well, is it hard to figure out? They erased Hatshepsut's name. Moses' name would have been eliminated by Thutmose III. Now, Thutmose III is going to become one of the great kings, great pharaohs of Egypt, and there's a whole history on that. He's going to be dead. That's after 40 years, 1446, God tells him it's time to go back. Those that were seeking your life are dead. Thutmose has died, and there's a new pharaoh in place. And if you look down here, I think I've got it in here somewhere. But the first long paragraph, the third line to the bottom, Thutmose III dies, and his son Amenhotep II, reigning from 1450 to 1425, begins to reign. So Amenhotep II was the pharaoh of the Exodus. Amenhotep was succeeded by Thutmose IV, 1425 to 1408, who was not the eldest son. Because why? Because the eldest son died in the death of the firstborn. And so Moses comes back from the wilderness, and I'll show you where he'd gone. He'd gone to, we've got a map coming here. Here is the Red Sea. There's the Mediterranean Sea, the Nile River coming down here. Moses left Egypt and went over to the land of Midian. He's probably over here. Traditionally, the Mount Sinai is here. This is the Red Sea. Israel's up here, but most likely he's over here shepherding sheep for 40 years. God tells him to come back. He appears to him on a mountain here, tells him to go back and get the people and bring them to this mountain, and God is going to meet them on this mountain. Now, there is a debate on which mountain it is. This mountain is the traditional mountain. You'll see that on your different maps. But that was picked out by a monk in the Middle Ages who said, oh, God showed him where it was at. But this lines up when Saul, the apostle, you know, became Paul, went to Arabia for 3 years. He goes down into this area is where he would have gone, not down here to Sinai. And he probably went down into this area here. So this is where they're going to have that mountain. There's a lot of evidence there. A lot of research is being done there. That's, the story's true as far as, you know, biblically we're following the text. But if you want to discuss this, the archaeological, that's something to look into. Well, anyway, when Moses comes back, as you know, and again, we've got to go all the way up to the time of Solomon, so I can't teach this verse by verse. He's going to strike in 1445, strike the land with 10 plagues. You know the negotiations. He comes into Amenhotep and says, let my people go. God's got a message for you. And he's going to strike the land with 10 plagues. Each one of them is going to have a chance to negotiate. Pharaoh's even going to at one time break and say, you can go. Then he's going to change his mind, and it gets more intense. The first, Nile turns to blood. Now, circled here, and this is in your notes there on the bottom of page 100 and 101 at the top. This is the name of each god. Of course, I was tempted to get an image of each of the gods. But the Nilus is the god of the river. Hakut is the frog-headed goddess of reproduction, and the frogs covered the land was the second plague. Lice came out of the dust, insulted the power of Seb, which was the god of the earth. So each of the Bible does not say he's plaguing or striking the gods of Egypt, but each of these gods, there was a god in charge of all of these things. But of course, that would make sense. If there's something that's important to the Egyptians, they're going to have a god in charge of it. So if they would have, you know, had, you know, the gasoline engines, you know, blow out their valves or something, there would have been a valve god that already existed. So it may be true or maybe not. But nonetheless, God is weakening the effect of the gods. Then flies begin to swarm. This comes from the word swarm. It's probably the dung beetle. And that is the god Kephira. Then the plague of the cattle strikes the sacred bull Apis and Hathor. Boils form on the Egyptian skin. Imhotep, the god of medicine. Hail and fire is the god of the atmosphere, is Nut and Shu. Then the locust is the god Sarapis. And then darkness proves the inability of Ra, the sun god. And then finally, the death of the firstborn is Ptah. P-T-A-H, that's all those gods are struck. But those are the 10 plagues that strike, and by that time, Pharaoh says, get out of my land, and he drives them out of the land. And here's where they're going to go, and they're going to leave that night. And this is where that mountain is at, Jebel El Lawrence, proposed Mount Sinai. Traditionally, it's here. Now, the crossing of the Red Sea, we're not sure where that takes place. If you're going here, you would have to cross the Red Sea right in here. If you're going down this way, you're trapped. You'd have to cross the Red Sea here and go up to the place that Moses would have seen God there after the 40 years of being a shepherd, and he meets right there. Notice some other things on this map before we go by. Here's the wilderness Paran. Here's Ezion Geber. Kadesh Barnea, they're going to spend a lot of time wandering right here. They're going to be sent up, the spies are going to be sent in to scout out the land. There's the Dead Sea, the Jordan River, scout out the land. They're going to bring a bad report. Do notice this. Here's the land of Edom. This is Jacob's brother Esau's people right here. Here's Moab and Ammon. These are the sons or the descendants of Lot and his two daughters, Moab and Ammon. Anyway, this is where Moses brings them out right here. They meet with God, and that's where they're going to get the law of law. Now here's a chart right here. Now this is not, well, let's see what's in your book, because you've got a book instead of looking at my slides. That's the plagues. We come on down, night of the firstborn. No Israelite was fully redeemed. Oh yeah. There's no Israelite that was fully redeemed that left Egypt. I mean, they're coming out, but they're not born again. They're not saved. Each Israelite needed to learn the laws and ways of God. And remember, they are Egyptians. Even Hebrews says Moses had been trained in all the ways of the Egyptians. So that He was an Egyptian, spoke Egyptian, looked like an Egyptian. In fact, when he goes to Midian, they find him and they say, there's an Egyptian here. And so he looks like an Egyptian. He walks like an Egyptian. Okay. God offered to enter into a conditional covenant. This is important. God is going to come up and offer them not an unconditional covenant, but a conditional. A conditional covenant. Now they've already got, these are the people of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they have the unconditional promise that God is going to make them into a great people, that the world is going to be blessed through them, that they're going to be given this land up here, the land of promise is theirs. And God says, I'm doing this. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Here on Mount Sinai, they're going to get, that was called an unconditional. I'm doing this. You just have to believe. If you're going to partake of this, you just have to accept to believe that I'm actually doing this. You can fight, you can reject it, you can run the other way, but God is going to do this. God is saving mankind. Mankind is going to be saved through the blood of Jesus Christ. Now you can run, you can hide, you can go, it's like, but God is in the process of fulfilling this covenant. All you've got to do to participate in it is believe, to accept it, to follow it, to let it change your life. The conditional covenant is going to have some stipulations. It's going to have some rules and regulations. The reason for the conditional covenant is to teach. And that's what's on, I've got it on the notes here coming up here in a minute, but on the bottom of page 101, there was three parts of this covenant that God gives Moses. You can read about it in Deuteronomy. So there's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In the book of Exodus, you've got a narrative, a historical account. Genesis and Exodus are historical. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus is going to be explaining the priesthood and some of the rituals and the sacrifices. Then Deuteronomy, that's the book of the law. That is where the law is established. Exodus is historical. Leviticus is the priestly book on how you behave, how you do the sacrifices. Deuteronomy is the law for the people. It is the conditional covenant. And then when you get to Numbers, you're going to once again have a historical account of what's taking place, of the continuing journeys that are taking place here. But in that conditional covenant, or the book of Deuteronomy, there are these things right here. The moral duties to God and man, that's seen in Exodus 20. Civil laws, Exodus 21 through 23. Religious rituals, Exodus 25 through 40. And then, of course, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, we're going to expand on them. So those three things, moral duties, civil laws, and religious rituals. Now notice right there, number one, morals. God is teaching them the moral duties, how to function morally. We're not following the Egyptians. We're following God's code of morals. Number two, the civil laws. These are the laws of the nation. This is how, you know, the stop signs, the speed limits, the tax codes, a variety of civil codes. This is not right or wrong. This is how you function in society. For example, number one, moral codes, you're not going to be able to change that. That morality would be a constant in most cases. Civil laws, those could be changed. I mean, are we going to drive on the left or the right side of the road? How much, who's going to pay the taxes? There's going to be some fluctuation. This is God establishing laws for his nation. Israel's now becoming a nation. They haven't been a nation, there's been a promise of a nation, but they're becoming a nation. And then religious rituals. Religious rituals are not moral. They're not civil laws. Religious rituals are the sacrifices, how you interact with God, what is sin before God, and how you atone for your sin. So you've got civil laws, you've got moral codes, and then you've got your relationship between God and man and how to maintain that relationship. And so the three requirements pointed out there at the bottom of page 101, God's standards of morality and righteousness are number one. Government code for the nation is number two, and the sacrificial system by which he could teach them the spiritual truths, including sin, substitution, and forgiveness. So when you go through number 1 and 2, if I were to make a statement here, 1 and 2 are general, not general, but it's the morality. Civil is the laws of the land. The religious rituals, now you're getting into God is trying to communicate something of spiritual value as far as now that you know that you what sin is, how do you atone for it? And he has a sacrifice. I would say, well, in many things, these things are always pointing towards Christ, but that religious rituals are the things that are pointing towards Christ. And Christ came and he has fulfilled this law. And so we are no longer under law. We saw that in Galatians. We saw that in Philippians. This right here, real quickly, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob's got 12 sons. We're talking here about one of the sons named Levi. Levi is going to have 3 sons, Gershom, Kohath, Merari. Kohath is going to have some sons. The son we're interested in is Amram. Amram is going to have 3 children, Aaron, Miriam, and a younger son, Moses. Now, if you notice, they're going to be in the Egypt for 4 generations, for 400 years, because the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. And here's Levi. Levi goes down to meet Joseph. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's your 4 generations. And that's the flow. Now Moses is going to meet Aaron. God is going to talk to Aaron and have him come out and meet Moses. Miriam's going to be part of the story. This goes on. That's what I just read to you. They're going to have in the directions, they're going to have plans for the tabernacle. I'm going to tell them how to build. This is a tent. It's very specific, very detailed. There's going to be this is the fence around it. I'll show you another picture. This is the tent or the tabernacle with the door. Out here is an altar of incense. A bronze altar. Bronze is on the outside. Bronze speaks of judgment. Everything on the inside is gold. Gold speaks of the presence of God. So on the outside, here's the altar for where they burn up the offerings. Here is a bronze basin where they'd wash the utensils, wash their hands. And then the priests could go in here, and there's going to be in here, let's look at another picture. Now you're looking at a top view. Here's the fence going all the way around the outside. If you notice, 150 cubits long, 75 feet this way. And then out here's the altar of burnt offering and the bronze basin. That's the bronze. This is out in the sunlight. You can see this. You go in this door right here. Hebrews could come in here. But only the priest could come in here. But only the high priest could go back here, and only one time a year. So here is a table of showbread. They'd put bread on that. Here is the golden lampstand. And here is where they'd burn incense. The golden altar, gold, gold, gold. And here is the Ark of the Covenant that's going to be a box of acacia wood covered in gold. And then there is a solid gold piece sitting on top of it, the 2 cherubim, the 2 angels hammered up out of the mercy seat. And again, a lot of things goes into this. All of this is rituals. This is going to morph into the temple. Right now, this is, you can pack this up. In fact, going back to this right here, that can be packed up and carried around the wilderness. And who gets to carry it? Levi, these people over here from Aaron's family are going to be the priest. Only Aaron is the high priest, and his sons will be the priest. But you go back up this genealogy, these are the sons of Levi, Gershom, Kohath, Merari. They are all called the Levites. Obviously, their father was Levi. So a priest is from the family of Kohath. He is, in a sense, a Levite, but because he's from Aaron, he is a priest. The Levites are not priests. They assist the priest. And, for example, Gershom would come in and take down the curtains, pack them up, fold them up, put them in the little row, whatever they're carrying them in. Then Merari would pull down the frames, all the studs, the beams, all the structure that holding up the curtains, and then Kohath would carry the furniture. So I would suppose Kohath would come in, they'd cover everything up. No one ever saw the Ark of the Covenant. There'd be a covering over it. They'd walk out with the Ark of the Covenant. They'd walk out with all the furniture. Then Gershom would come in, pull all the curtains, fold them up, and then Merari would grab the frames, take the bolts out, screws out, yeah, bolts, and however they held them together, and they'd move to the next location, and they would follow the presence of God, because God would appear there over the holy place. In the right over here, God's presence would appear on this part right there. Oh no, here we go. Come on, help me out here. There it is, but we got to go all the way back. Oh, there we are, there we are, there we are. Okay, okay, this is entertaining for all of us. Okay, so that's who's carrying all this stuff. That's the tabernacle. Now, right here, all the Israelites have to camp, and they have 12 tribes, so they camp in their tribes. You've got the tribe of Levi, you've got the tribe of Judah, tribe of Issachar. Well, right here, see the tabernacle? There's the fence around the tabernacle. There's the outer court. But right here, Moses and Aaron and the priests stayed right here. The Levites of Merari stayed here. The Levites of Gershom stayed here. The priests of Kohath stayed here. The tribes, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun stayed here. There'd be 186,000 people camping on this side. Over here, there'd be Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. Manasseh and Ephraim are Joseph's sons. So this is really the tribe of Joseph right here, his two sons. Now the 12th tribe is where? Levite is here. So they took Joseph, split it in two, so they still got 12. There's 7,500 over here. Now watch, 186,000, because they've got the census in the Bible. Tells you who's all. 186,000 here, 7,500 here. Which group is bigger, boys and girls? Okay. Then you got Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, 157,000. Reuben, Simeon, and Gad, 151,000. So these are pretty even. So if we were to draw that out, if you're going to fly over that with your drone, you'd have the tabernacle with the holy place right here, the presence of God coming down right here. And it would meet Moses. Sometimes he'd come out and go to the front of the door and talk to Moses. The presence of God, it'd be the presence of God. But you've got your largest group here, smallest group here. You've got two even groups right here. Now, boys and girls, if you turn that to up, stand that up, you've got, what do you got? You've got a cross. Now, again, if that's intentional, that's one thing, just like, it's the truth. But is that the point of it? I don't know, but that's the way it is. So here it looks real even, but it would be a cross. Okay. The priesthood genealogy, Aaron is going to have Eleazar, Ithamar. We're going to end up having two groups of priests. That's coming up later in the Old Testament because they're both priests, but they're going to have a power group. Here's the same thing we just looked at. Here's the feast. We're not going to talk about this, but listed in Leviticus 23, all the details here are talking about the feast that you're going to have throughout the year. The Feast of Passover, to remember the Passover where the firstborn didn't die. Feast of Unleavened Bread, when they had to take bread without putting yeast in it. First fruits, that's in April. The Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks. Trumpets, Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement. And the Feast of Tabernacles is all described there in the book. And it's part of the year. It's part of their calendar. I just showed that to you. Now, this is where they met the Lord over here, either Mount Sinai here, or over here, Mount Sinai, over here in Arabia. And they came up here into this area, into what is called Kadesh Barnea, the desert of Paran. There's Israel's camp. There's the tabernacle. And at that point, in Numbers 13, now we're back, we're going to start telling the story again. Numbers 13, they're ready to take the land, go to the promised land. They've got the law, they got the rituals, they got the priesthood set up, got the tabernacle set up. Let's go take the land. So Moses comes up here. He's been waiting. He's like 81 years old. He's been waiting 40 years as a crown prince, another 40 years in the wilderness. Now he's come back, let him out here. He's talked with God. His hair's gone gray. You saw the movie. And now he's here. It's like, it's time to, he's 81 years old, 82 years old. It's time to go take the land. So they take a spy from each tribe, send them up in the land, and they come back. And two guys come back, Joshua and Caleb, come back with a positive report. Yes, we got this. The other 10 are like, I don't know. We saw some of the descendants of the Nephilim there. It's like, we saw, it's like, those are big people. Now again, if they're exaggerating, some people say they're lying. Some people thought they actually saw giants there, the descendants of the Nephilim. And that's all debatable. But nonetheless, they were terrified of the people, and they spread a bad report. and the people refused to go. And then obviously God says, okay, you can't go. You guys spend 40 years in the wilderness. All you guys are going to die. We'll just wander around here in the wilderness for 40 years into this whole generation. Now notice 40 years. That's the generation. It had been apparently 100 years. At this point, it switches to 40 years until this generation dies. And then we go, except for Joshua and Caleb, because they were said, we can do it. So now Joshua and Caleb, they've got to wait 40 years. Now just take yourself right now, and you're ready to take the promised land. And God says, well, no, we can't because these guys aren't obeying. You've got to wait 40 years. So now you take your age and you add 40 years to it. It's like, I'm 65. We got to wait 40 years. I'm 105. And now we're going to go take the promised land at 105. It's like, oh my gosh. Well, some of these guys are like that. Joshua and Caleb was like, how old are we? 40 more years. And Moses, he's 80, 82, 40 more years. He's going to be 120. Oh, okay. But anyway, they're going to do that. So they come back with a negative report, and that's in Kadesh Barnea. And what leads to this is wandering. Again, that's pretty precise. We're not sure exactly where they were. They'd stay some places. They'd stay somewhere for a long time, several months, maybe a couple years, before they wouldn't move like every weekend and just keep walking. They'd camp out different places, but they're in the wilderness. And that's Numbers chapter 16 through 19 talks about the 40 years in the wilderness right there. Notice where the Dead Sea's at. They're down here just north of the Gulf of Aqaba right there, called Ezion Geber in the map right there. Now, during this time, several things happen. Now you got 40 years of miserable people in the wilderness eating manna. They're going to complain about the manna. They're going to complain about, well, Kohath, one of the Levites, is going to get mad and say, wait. Who told Moses he was in charge? I mean, we're all Levites. All of it, instead of Moses saying, well, the priests are holy, the other people are not, they're like, wait a minute. We're all holy. Everyone's holy. And then God has to bring judgment on them. And what ends up happening through a series of events right here, 200 Levites they want to burn incense, just like the priests. See, like the priests get to burn incense, but the Levites can only help them. They can get the incense ready, you know, clean the utensils, but the priests get to burn them. And so finally Moses says, go ahead. Make yourself incense burners of bronze. Now, all the incense burners were gold. But he tells Levites, you make them of bronze and just go ahead and go do it. And when they got in there and they started doing their little chants, you know, whatever they're doing, and they're burning their incense before God, the Levites here that were following, 250 of them, fire from the Lord, who's back here, and smoked them. And now you've got this whole court littered with charred bodies and smoldering incense, bronze incense burners. And so Moses says, drag those bodies out to the dump, but pick those bronze incense burners up, because that's valuable stuff. It'll be a great memorial plaque to make. And they hammered into something for a memorial on how stupid these people were, and says, anybody else got any questions about who God has chosen? And no, they didn't. And so that was one of the things that took place. Here's the land that you can see. Can you see this? Land of Midian, that's where Moses went from Egypt to the land of Midian. So it's pretty clear he wasn't pasturing a sheep down here in the land of Egypt. He was in the land of Midian pasturing a sheep when the Lord appeared to him on the mountain. There's land of Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and then the Arameans are up here. Now, when it comes time to start moving to the promised land, they're going to come over here and camp. Moses wants to pass through Edom. And so he sends messengers to Edom and says, we want to pass through. And the king of Edom, Esau's descendant, tells Jacob's descendants, you can't come through here. We have a border. You have to go around Edom. So Moses goes, okay, listen. Let me make sure I'm clear. We will stay on the interstate. We'll pick up our trash. We'll keep the dog poop out of the ditch. We'll take the poop with us. We won't even drink from your wells. We'll take water and carry it through your land. We'll stay right on the interstate. Can we please walk through your land? And even that time, the king sent the military out to the border and said, no. And God says to Moses, well, you'll have to walk around. I've given that land to Esau. Now, think about that. I mean, there's a lesson right there. Moses asked twice, please, we just want to pass through. And Edom, God gave it to Edom, and Edom says, we don't want you, we don't trust what you're doing. We don't know the game here. Plus, Jacob stole our birthright. I'm not sure what the whole reason was, but they did. And when they says, it's our land, it's our border, no, you can't. God says, well, you better go around, because if you go through that land and there's a war, I'm not helping. I'll just watch. So Moses packed up the tabernacle, all the people, and they walked all the way around Edom and came through Moab, and they're camping up here. Now, Moab is concerned about it. Moab, you see, right there's Moab. Israel's camp is right up here. Now, that's a Shittim, and that apparently is Tel Haman, which is Sodom. It's the remains of Sodom. It's a tell that they were camping. It's not a, they weren't in a city. It's a location. Again, this is huge, debatable, because the people still think Sodom's down here on the east side of the Dead Sea. I think it's straight across from Jericho, where you can see it from Bethel and Ai. And there's good evidence for that. But nonetheless, they're camped here. But while they're there, the king of Moab is concerned, and he sends for Balaam. See right where at Pethor, see where that's at? That's right, if you're in Genesis class, that's right up there by Padan Aram, or right by Haran, where Laban was practicing divination. Well, he's a prophet, and he's going to come down. He's the king of Moab sends someone up to get Balaam and bring him down to curse Israel. And he's, I'll pay you. And Balaam asks God, he prays, should I go? God says, don't go. And they offer him money again. So he prays again. He goes, okay, you go, but you be very careful. And he gets warned by the donkey. The angel meets him. The angel of the Lord, probably the second member of the Trinity, Son of God, talks to him. And he comes down, and he sets up an altar. He burns incense and looks down at the people, and he offers sacrifices. And he has five times he's going to curse the people of Israel. And Balak, the king of Moab, is there watching. Because he knows if he can curse these people, they won't bother him. And as soon as Balaam, now this is amazing, as soon as Balaam opens his mouth, they're recording the book of Numbers, five blessings, speaking of Israel's prosperity, Israel's future, is spoken. And Balak, the king, goes, that's not what I paid you for. Here, let's go over here. This is a better view. You can see him from the, and he went to five different locations, built five different altars, offered sacrifices. And every time, one, two, three, four, five, he blesses Israel. In fact, he says, I see him, but not now. I see him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob, and he'll crush the heads of Moab. It's like he's prophesying about the Messiah. It's in the book of Numbers. So Balaam comes down here in the hills of Moab, looking down on Israel to curse them, being paid by Balak, and he ends up prophesying. So this guy is, it's one of those tough situations. He's a Gentile prophet who's being paid, but he's got some relationship with God, because God is speaking to him on a couple of occasions, even up here, and the angel Lord meets him here. So this is a Gentile prophet, and when he does open his mouth and speak, it is the word of God. It's recorded in Scripture. In fact, it's some prophecies that are in there that we hold to. Now, nonetheless, that happens. Now, what takes place, he ends up telling Balak, I can't curse these people, but you can make them sin and their God will strike them. So here's what I suggest. It's not explicit in the text, but it's understood this way, because Balaam ends up dying because of this sin. But he says, what you need to do is send all your women down into the camp. You know, get those, I want to say skimpy, but you don't know what, you know, fashions change. So whatever, like, you know, an Israel man can't take his eyes off of when they're dressed like this, whatever it is, you know, gold in their eyebrows or gold earrings that dangle, or, you know, exposed skin or unexposed skin or covered faces, you know, whatever, you know, eyes painted up, whatever it is, and all the women go down and they're dancing or strutting or doing whatever. It's like the guys are like, woo, look at her. And they lead them into sexual sin and into sacrificing to the false gods, to the gods of Moab. So they're violating the moral code, they're violating the civil code, and they're violating the religious code, the sacrificial code. And they're coming against God. They're having sexual relations with foreign women, and they are the Israelites. These are the Israelites. You just spent 40 years in the wilderness. You're like 2 weeks across, going across the promised land. And you like, what? And the prophet can't curse them, but he can say, I know how to make them sin. And so they sin, and God strikes many of them dead. Balaam ends up dying, and that's that story right there. That's in Numbers 22. Now we're at the end of the book of Numbers. Here's the land, Numbers 34. There's a land promised. It's set in Genesis. It's set in Joshua. Here's the land that's promised to Israel right here, and they're camping right here, getting ready to go across there, and that is the book of Numbers. And there it is, Shittim, which is 7 miles from the Jordan. It looks like it's, now you're on this page of notes right here that I handed out. If you go back to your book, page 102, there's a picture of the tabernacle. On page 102, there's a picture of, where Mount Sinai's at. And now we're ready for the crossing of the Jordan. And this is where Moses dies here. He goes up into a mountain, dies with the Lord. No one knows where he died. No one knows where his body. There's no tomb. There's no coffin. There's no markings. He died, and the Lord buried him. And Joshua now is the leader, and he's now at Shittim, and he of course sends a couple spies across there to check. Stays with the story. Rahab sends the guards away a different way, and the spies escape out the window, and they come back and say, "Well, the people are afraid of us." So now they're going to cross the Jordan River, and they're carrying the Ark of the Covenant. When they come right across here, Israel camps for 3 days on this side of the Jordan, on the east side, and then it's time to cross. So they put the priests, take the Ark of the Covenant. Do I have an Ark of the Covenant sitting here somewhere? I've got a little gold one. Where is it at? Okay. Oh, somebody hit it, like grandma. Anyway, nonetheless, it's a box. It's about this big. Now, I don't have a full-size Ark of the Covenant, otherwise it would be hidden. And then there's acacia poles covered with wood, or wooden acacia poles going through. Apparently the feet have loops in them, and there's a long, so a priest would carry it on this, so the Ark would be here. They'd have on their shoulder. There'd be something in front of him with their shoulder. And then on this side, there'd be two priests carrying it like this. And they step down into the water, here. The water stops, piles up here at a place called 16 miles away. Water piles up at a place called Adam. And they walk across. And Joshua says, a man from every tribe, pick up one of these large boulders from the bottom of the Jordan River. Now, again, if it's been in the river for years, it's smooth and round. It's not a jagged rock. Pick it up and pile it up right here. There's a pile of 12 stones. Right here, it's called Gilgal, possibly. It's a place called Gilgal, but they pile them up at Gilgal, which means the place of the circle. So they probably took those stones, which is common, and they made a monument out of it. And people would still go to this place during the Old Testament. You're not always sure where this is. They went to the monument. They went to the stones. They went to the place of the circle or whatever. But they went to that place where those stones were piled up. And how did they come? They came, and Joshua says, when your sons ask, where did these come from? And you say, they came from the bottom of the Jordan, and you can't swim up with one of these. They had it dried up, and we walked across. So they go to Gilgal, and they wait. That's where Joshua goes off, and he's spying on Jericho, kind of looking at it himself, just kind of thinking about it. And the angel of the Lord appears, and Joshua draws sword and says, who are you for us or for the enemy? And the angel of the Lord says, neither. But as the commander of the Lord's army, I've now come to you to tell you. And he gives him instructions on how to take the city of Jericho. And that's what you see there on that next page. You've got, they're going to cross over and take Jericho. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 points on the top of page 103. There's going to be in Joshua chapter 6 through 9. It's going to be called the entry campaign or the central campaign. There's going to be the entry and central campaign. Then there's going to be the southern campaign. And then there's going to be the northern campaign that they're going to go ahead and move through the land. And it's going to take 5 years. It's not like in an afternoon. They're going to go through the land because they've got to fight these Canaanites, the Amorites, the foreign people that are here. They've had 400 years in God's mind. Some of them were friendly with Abraham. Some of them had treaties with Abraham. But you could not marry into them because now your genetics are mixed with the people that I'm going to come and destroy. But in 400 years, or four generations, counting them as 100, they become so corrupt, they're in the fourth cycle of discipline. They're going to be eliminated from history. You do not want to end up in the fourth cycle of discipline as a nation. And again, read Hope for America's Last Generation. Entry campaign, Joshua 6 through 9. The central campaign, Joshua 10. They're going to fight the five kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. They're going to face those five kings. Then they're going to go on the southern campaign where Israel takes the cities of Lachish, Gezer. Remember Gezer. Eglon, Hebron. Remember, that's where Abraham's city was. And Debir. They seduce the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills, and the mountain slopes. And then they go on the northern campaign all the way up north to Hazor. And we'll look at that. But here it is right here. Here is Gilgal. Now they're going to go across. This is a picture. I think you've got that on your notes there that I handed out to you. Here's a looking down from the north, looking down the Rift Valley, down towards Jericho. Jericho is the lowest city on the earth. It's one of the oldest cities in history, and it's right next to the Dead Sea, like right here, which is the lowest place on the earth. These are some remains of the city of Jericho. Now, here is the walls of Jericho. To understand this and what you're going to see, these are retaining wall right here, you see? This is a retaining wall, stone wall, and then built up on top of this was probably a mud wall standing up here. And there were two walls right here, protecting the city. Josh is going to march around it seven times, or, you know, for 7 days, and the seventh day they're going to march around it seven times. And the walls fall, and excavation, this is Jericho. The walls weren't knocked in. Whenever the Romans come, they bang on the wall and knock them in, or the Babylonians, whatever. These walls collapsed out. And what you see right here is that stone. You say, why is there a wall in Jericho? That's not the wall. That's the retaining wall. That's the landscape wall, if you would. And then the clay bricks, or the mud bricks, were built up on top of that. And those clay bricks fell out. Rahab's house was on the wall. Now, that doesn't mean she lived in the wall. I remember talking to a lady who's a Chinese lady that was with us one time in 2012, and she was asking, how can this be? Well, see, like right here, these are mud bricks. See this right here? Remains of residences built up against the city wall. These are the mud walls of residences. Rahab would have lived in one of these houses on the wall. And that I was explaining the English, like I'm an English teacher, but you can be on the wall or you can be standing on the wall. These houses were on the wall, or better yet, against the wall, if you accept that. And then this part right here fell out, and the retaining wall stayed there. Here's the base, the retaining of one of the two walls. Here's the other one up there. And here's another picture of it. You can see this wall, this wall. There's the Tell of Jericho. See, there's a tunnel dug by Kenyon going through there and looking for artifacts and things. There, you can see very clearly the mud bricks right here, butted right up against, or very close to being against the stone wall right there. That's the stone retaining wall, which originally supported the mud wall. Now, I'm standing in that tell right here. I'm standing up in here looking around, and I look towards the Jordan River. Down in here is the Jordan River. That's overlooking towards Sodom, or Shittim, where Joshua had come from, where Moses had camped. This is the city of Jericho today. City of Palms, because there's a natural spring right here. It's called Elisha Spring, because it got bitter. There's death in it. So Elisha had put salt in it, and it made it pure. And I drank from it. I just, right out to my hand, just took drink out of it, you know. Lowest place on earth, and you're drinking water out of a spring. Well, I'm here today. But anyway, so that's my adventure. Okay, that's what that looks like. Now, they take Jericho, and then they send out to fight Ai, and they're defeated. And there's a small town. They couldn't figure out why they were defeated, and they were defeated because someone had taken the Babylonian garment and the bars of gold, and God wasn't with them. So they have another time they fight. The second time, they send 5,000 troops, are going to march out number one, and they're going to approach the city. This is now Joshua 7 and 8. They approach the city like the first time, but now they start running in retreat. And the people of Ai go, ha, 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 we're doing it again. But Joshua had 30,000 troops sitting up here. And when the men of Ai ran after the retreating troops of Israel, 30,000 troops stepped right in there and just slaughtered the city. And then 5,000 troops had their back over here, protecting anyone from coming from Beth Aven or Bethel, coming down to help Ai, and Ai was eliminated. That's Joshua chapter 7 and 8. That's the entry campaign there. Now, here's the central campaign. There's Gilgal. where the stones are, there's Jericho, there's Ai, and then they move south down here and go through, that's the entrance, then this, going to the south right here. But notice right here, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, what Joshua does at this point, he goes up on between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. One of them, they read the curses of the law. The other, they read the blessings of the law. And they recently found a little token, a little scroll, a little omelet, they would call it, with the curses written on it in this very location right here. I mean, from that time period. And he set up a stone there as a memorial because these people, you can't forget the law of Moses. You can't forget what God has done for you. And so they go up here, and this right here is there today. And it's, there is a standing stone right here, and there's a temple that's been built around it, Baal Berith. It's a temple fortress. There's Sechem. There's Mount Ebal. There's Mount Gerizim right there, and there's a valley right here with a stone. And that standing stone most likely is the stone that Joshua stood up when they made this, the curse of the covenant right here. They read the curse and the blessings. There it is again, and that's the reason. Now, this was going to be used several times. This is going to be used in Judges. It's going to be used for pagan worship. It's going to be used, everything's going to become idolatry. There's a couple other pictures up between Mount Gerizim, and they do that. Now, there's again the southern campaign. They take this land. This is the book of Joshua. Now they go up north. Again, a lot of stories taking place here. They go from the northern campaign, go all the way up to Hazor right there. And Hazor, you can see right here, here's the, some details. Hazor is just north of Galilee. And this is the palace of, there it is again. There's the palace of the Canaanites. Again, this beam right here is not Canaanite, but this altar right here is Canaanite. You can see some basalt stones around here. You can see a mud brick walls right here. You can see basalt foundation. See these pillars right here? Those are new modern replications, but they're standing on basalt circle bases where pillars stood to hold up the remains of the palace or the temple. This was burnt by Joshua in Joshua chapter 11 in Hazor, Israel in the north up there. There's this the courtyard, and you kind of figure that out right there. This is me standing right here. You see this? See those metal beams kind of holding the brick, mud bricks, so they don't collapse. This part right here. This is me standing right there, touching. See, I see they're clay bricks or mud bricks that were made, and you still see the straw and stuff that's in there. Here's some of the basalt stones from the palace that was probably could have cracked in the fire. Because it got to be extremely hot. Now, they divide the land of the 12 tribes. Each are going to get their own land. We can go back into the story, but Reuben decided they want to stay on this side. Gad wanted to stay on this side, and they could as long as they came across and helped conquer the land, because this is good pasture land. This is very nice land over here. Half tribe of Manasseh, that's Joseph's son, Manasseh, his you know, Joseph's great-great-great-grandchildren. Half of them stayed there, and here's the land of Judah. This is Judah takes this land right down here. They're dividing the land up. Here's some, there's Ephraim, half, the other half of Manasseh, Issachar, and those are just, you know, we're not going to go through all the details, but here's everything. There's everybody's land right there. Now notice Levites don't have any land, because Levites have cities in every town because they're the teaching tribe. They've got their centers for teaching in their in those lands. Now the ark is going to, or the tabernacle is going to be set up in Shiloh. This is 2004 in Shiloh, probably a place in Shiloh where the ark, or the ark, the tabernacle would have sat. 150 feet. I just drew that on there. That's speculation, but that is Shiloh. I go back in 2012 and notice what they did to it. They've excavating it. And what they're finding here, Shiloh, right here at this location, it's a community. There's people there, but there's no houses. It's like a tourist place. It's where people come and they leave. They don't stay there. And there's a bunch of animal bones that are sacrificed there. I believe, is this the place where the bones that they found were only from the right side? Was this place right here? They found, as they're going through, they're just finding piles of bones in the garbage where they, after they got done burning them, eating them. But the left side would be given to the priest to take as their own. Is that the way the story goes? And the right side was what was offered to God. And so what they found here on the sacrifices was, it was a cultic place. Not a cult like evil, but where it was a center of worship, and they had very consistent of the same thing repeated over and over again here in Shiloh. And you can read about this. They're excavating. This is me looking. There's some pot shirts. See the pot shirts down here? You see some pot shirts up here, but nonetheless, that's Shiloh right there. What takes place now in the book of Judges is now the people are in the land. They've got to drive some people out. But at this point, this is the cycle that goes throughout the book of Judges. The book of Judges takes place. Well, let's turn the page here. Yeah, on page 105. There's that circle. The date, 1380 to 1050. 1380 to 1050 BC is the book of Judges. Now, this is gonna end. Joshua has just died. Caleb and his family are just dying. He's dying. His sons are coming into here. But right here, by 1050, you're going to have Samuel is one of the last judges. He's going to choose Saul because people want to have a king named Saul, or they want a king like everybody else. God wants to be a theophany. I've met you at Mount Sinai. I've given you your moral code. I've given you your laws. I've given you the religious system to stay in contact. I will fight for you. I've given you this land. I'm going to fulfill in front of you the promise spoken to Abraham. You've got to keep the unconditional covenant. But while you're keeping that unconditional Mosaic covenant, I am going to be fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant, the unconditional covenant through you. But keep following the law. So they're supposed to do this, but quickly they go into spiral. They spiral out. Now, by 1040, you're going to end up having David's coming into the scene. So this is now you're getting into David is very close right here. But this is now the time of what was called the judges. And they're basically the judges are basically local leaders, local chieftains that people look to for deliverance. But the cycle goes like this. They're thankful. It's a renewed society. Yay, God, we're following God. And then they prosper. They've got all kinds of, you know, food and peace. And they become self-sufficient and they forget God. And they know it's based on education. Education and making good decisions and investing your money. We can show you the way, a humanistic way, self-sufficient. This is the way you make a culture work. And they began to forget God and start making rules. Whatever. I can start making examples from our own culture that we're going to prove that we can do this by, you know, every child will be able to read, but we're not going to teach about God, but we're going to educate them. Well, now you're going to have intelligent academic sinners who have forgotten about God, and now they seek pleasure, and they have to follow idolatry. They're going to find some way to worship something, and they're going to find false gods, especially because there's some still around them, because the people are not, many of the tribes do not successfully drive the people out. Like the tribe of Dan was supposed to drive out the people in the land of Philistia, Gaza, and that whole area there, and they didn't. They just stayed up there in the hill, they didn't come down into the plain. It was too hard. Others, they lived with them. Other tribes just said, okay, you can live, but you got to be our servants. So why do we want to, we're just enslave the people. So they use them as slaves or servants. Well, the servants are going to rise up and rebel against them, just like the slaves in Egypt rose up. And so get rid of them, because they bring in this idolatry. Once they're into seeking pleasure and idolatry, they end up in oppression and slavery. They do it to themselves. Because of stupid thinking, bad decisions, you end up in oppression and you end up being a slave yourself. Why? Because you became self-sufficient and you lived against the will of God. You found new idolatry or new ways of thinking that leads you into oppression and slavery. Now they go, I remember Grandpa was so happy. He was following God and things were so good. And they become a desperate society. And they go, oh, I wish we were like Grandpa was or Great-Grandpa. And they cry out to God and they're in, we'll do whatever it takes. We want to come back to God. Okay. And he raises up a judge and they lead them and deliver them and bring them back into freedom. It's like, yay, we're so happy because of Gideon, and we're so happy because of Deborah. We're so happy because of whoever. And now they got a renewed society. They're thankful they serve God. They become self-sufficient. And this just goes around and around. That's the book of Judges. There's the book of Judges. Just we tell it to you 12 times or more. And that's the way it happens. And that's what you've got right here. Between these years, you've got these people popping up. You've got Gideon making himself an ephod. Now, after Gideon delivered everybody, he has them make him an ephod, which is makes himself a priest. Abimelech slaughters 70 of his stepbrothers in one stone. He delivers them, but then he kills all of his brothers because they didn't support him. Jephthah He goes off, he makes a vow before he goes to battle, says, if the Lord delivers me and I return home, whatever comes out of my house first, I'll offer it as a sacrifice. And he wins the battle, comes home, pulls in, hey, I'm home, everybody. And his young daughter comes running out of the house, dancing and playing a tambourine. Oh, daddy, you're home. It's like, oh no, I've got to keep my vow. And apparently he sacrificed his daughter. Now some people say, well, you know, he just dedicated her to, had to go live in a temple somewhere, or some she just couldn't get married, she had to be a virgin. But if you read the story and you know the culture, he killed his daughter. I mean, you can try to temper it down so it fits your Sunday school mind, but he probably slaughtered his daughter because he made a vow to God. Now we're talking this time period right here. How do I say this? We're talking right here. Stupid people. They don't know anything. They're following the pagans. Just because you get delivered and God gets you set up again, what do you need to do right here once you've been delivered? You're going to have to renew your mind. You're going to have to learn the ways of God. But instead, you just say, oh, and go right back into here again. It's always comes down to, do you know anything? Are you intelligent? Do you understand what God's will is? And they failed over and over again. Goes all the way through. Micah, a young Levite. You've got the tribe of Dan. Oh, it goes on and on. And we're at 8 o'clock right here. And now, coming up to this point right here, I got all kinds of things right here, and I've got to quit. How about we pick this up next week, huh? I mean, we got to, otherwise it's going to get ridiculous. I didn't make it to Solomon, but I'll just use these pictures next week. We'll go through this, because I've got, as you can see right there, I've got, if you want this and you have it, I've got for you some very nice, not very nice, I made these in 1986, 87. Okay, I drew them by hand and made copies of them. But these are the book of Judges showing you different places. I've got the verses written down there, describe it, and that gives you some locations of where those things are at. Kind of covers some of the stories of who's who and what's going on. Now remember, 86, let's say 85, that's 40 years ago. So I made these maps 40 years ago, and then with a pen. And then I make copies, you know, a bunch of copies of the blank map on a copy machine. And then I draw on there, and then I make copies of it. And I just put them on. They're all online. You see it says Galen Games right there. That's my little game company. I had Christian card games that I designed and produced. But that, again, the reason I'm telling you that is because after 40 years of research, archaeology, study, there may be some things there that I would move around, I'd put in a different place, but it at least gets you started, at least gets you going the right direction. We'll pick up in, 1380, the book of Judges. Our overview of the Old Testament that we're going to do in 6 weeks, we're doing it in 7 weeks. I'm sorry. Okay, I'll pray, and if you have any questions or thoughts or insights, please feel free. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into your word. We thank you for what you've presented to us, what you have saved for us in the scriptures, and we ask that we would use these as guidance for our own lives, that we would do the things you've called us to, that we would not become self-sufficient, but we'd continue to trust you and learn your ways and walk in the things you've called us to. Again, thank you for this opportunity, and we pray for our nation that we would pull ourselves out of this fourth cycle of discipline and renew ourselves again in Jesus' name. In his name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being here.